Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. President Obama's recent discussion with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was so frosty that icicles were seen hanging from the White House roof as summer approached. Perhaps that is a hyperbolic statement, but not by much. Their meeting 2 weeks ago was preceded by Obama's May 19th speech, in which he called for a return to the borders that existed before the 1967 Six-Day War, at least as a starting point for negotiations to create a Palestinian state. Netanyahu retorted that those boundaries are indefensible and would jeopardize Israel's security. So here with us today to talk about the situation in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, and more is Dr. Karen Peterson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at MTSU. It is assistant, right?
Associate.
We'll start that over. Here with us today to talk about the situation in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, and more is Dr. Karen Peterson, Associate Professor of Political Science at MTSU. Thanks for being with us, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Did anything good actually come out of Netanyahu's visit to Washington on May 20th?
I think Netanyahu's reception in Congress was overwhelmingly positive. And politically speaking, I'm not sure that he gained much ground that he didn't already have, just like I don't think Obama lost much ground that he had not already lost, domestically anyway.
It's sort of a wash for an American president with his own electorate, isn't it, that the situation in the Middle East is seen as being so intractable that if you make progress, great, but if you don't, nobody's going to think less of you.
I think that's exactly right. If you don't harm the situation any further, then you're probably in good shape. And we're a year and a half away from the next election, roughly, so the timing is probably good for Obama. Any problems from his speech will be long forgotten.
Did you think it in any way damaged the U.S.-Israeli relationship?
I think damage would be too strong of a word. I don't think it damaged the relationship. I mean, it's a close relationship. I think there were some problematic aspects from the Israeli perspective. And I mean, I saw one news article that said there's something for everyone to hate in Obama's speech, and I think that's about right. But I think damaging the U.S.-Israeli relationship would just be too strong of language.
In advance of this taping, protests took place along the Syrian and Lebanese borders in observance of Nakba Day, May 15th, which commemorates the creation of Israel. Nakba, it's Arabic for Day of the Catastrophe.
Right.
Israeli Defense Forces killed and wounded scores of people who apparently were seen as trying to get across the border. Some did get beyond the fence. The Six-Day War was fought in 1967 between June 5th and June 10th, so we are airing on June 5th right now. And there has been a call on Facebook for more protest to mark the 44th anniversary of the Six-Day War. Is it going to be deja vu all over again?
I think that would be exactly what some of these regimes need. The Syrian regime, for example, can use this as a distraction technique from the obvious problems domestically that Syria is having, and to encourage people to march on the borders of another sovereign state with which you have hostile relations, knowing full well that the response is going to be a military response. That's calculated. That's not accidental. And yeah, it's probably going to happen again within the next couple of days. And there's a call for a third intifada to come on the heels of either this event or the UN event in September.
So the timing of President Clinton's comment, I believe it was either Wednesday or Thursday, I can't recall which, that Assad's credibility is just about shot. That's a rough paraphrase. It's not President Clinton's exact words. The timing of that is no coincidence either.
No, it's not. And, Clinton has said that these regimes are on the wrong side of history. And I think that might be calling the game a little too early. This is sort of like Francis Fukuyama talking about the end of history at the end of the Cold War and how liberal democracy has triumphed. I mean, we do not know what the outcome of these regime changes will be. Even in places like Egypt, where it looked relatively positive, there's no guarantee that liberal democracy or even illiberal democracy will be the outcome in these cases.
Nation building is still a crapshoot.
State building is a crapshoot. Nation building is a crapshoot. And, you know, what... our ideas about what these regimes should look like are probably not realistic, mm-hmm. at given the levels of economic and political development in these countries.
And are seen by people in those countries as the West attempting to impose its rubric or its template on top of their culture and their history, right?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you know, military interference and military operations in Libya just sort of reinforce the perception in the Middle East of the West, just finding another way to be imperialist, neo-imperialism.
Mm-hmm. The Palestinians are maneuvering for recognition as an independent state at a United Nations General Assembly meeting in September. What impact will this have on that effort, by which I mean the Obama-Netanyahu discussions, if any?
Well, I don't think it affects necessarily the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Obama quite wisely came down against that political maneuver. That maneuver itself is likely to do more damage to the peace process than good. And of course, it means absolutely nothing tangibly for the U.N. General Assembly to recognize Palestine. I mean, they pass dozens of resolutions, anti-Israeli resolutions every year, so this would be yet another in a string of anti-Israel resolutions that they pass every year. But it may create a more hardliner attitude on the side of the Palestinians in terms of peace negotiations. Not that that doesn't already exist.
Is that about all the Palestinians can expect to get out of it in terms of anything viable?
Well, nothing viable really is going to come out of it. If it were to even pass, which it very well might, because this is majority rule, then the best they're going to get out of it is another tool of political rhetoric that can be used by Hamas, Fatah, the other Arab states in the region. That's about the best that can come out of it. The worst that comes out of it is a hardening of the Palestinian stance and that third intifada that is being actively and openly advocated by Palestinians in social media right now.
So procedurally, just as a little bit of housekeeping, a little bit of UN housekeeping here, this is a General Assembly meeting. This is not a Security Council meeting where one country can veto anything and it's dead.
Right. It won't come up in the Security Council simply because it would not pass.
Okay. How much would UN recognition mean for the Palestinians mean to other Arab states if it were to pass? And we're dealing in the realm of the hypothetical.
I mean, it's a political tool. It certainly would give them the, I guess, enhanced political recognition for some of the political justification that these regimes use internally for their policies. The Palestinian issue, from the perspective of some of these Arab states, the Palestinian-Israeli issue has been the most effective way for them to maintain autocratic rule. They've been able to use this issue as a wedge issue and essentially a reason for their existence as autocratic states. And when this recognition comes, if it does come, and there is no tangible outcome for that, then this is just yet another way for them to say, look, the whole world wants this, but the United States is standing between us and this Palestinian state.
So it's basically a propaganda tool.
Oh, yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Does Hamas's attempt to reconcile with Fatah, the organization that controls the West Bank and the Palestinian Authority, make any difference?
Absolutely. Hamas has failed to or refuses to recognize the right of Israel to exist, and Israel cannot and should not negotiate with an organization that will not at least on principle recognize the right of Israel to exist as a sovereign state. And if Abbas doesn't recognize that and isn't willing, as Netanyahu said, to separate himself and the Palestinians from Hamas, then there is no there's no peace process. There's no negotiation.
Does this make Hamas stronger?
That's a good question. Maybe it gives them a little bit more political cards, but they do control a very small segment of the Palestinian territory. Right? They don't have the majority of the Palestinian territory, and in terms of accountability, there's very little accountability for what they do inside Gaza Strip. So I don't know that it really strengthens them or weakens them. They have refused to take a stance, a pro sort of negotiation stance, a stance that says anything other than Israel must be destroyed. And this is the same group that criticized us for killing Osama bin Laden and for overtly criticized the United States for taking out a great man.
Mm-hmm. Well, Netanyahu has made it clear, hasn't he, that the Hamas-Fatah reconciliation or detente, whatever you want to call it, doesn't make any difference to him. It's still a deal breaker as far as he's concerned, right?
Well, you can't, I mean, you can't negotiate with someone who refuses to recognize your right to exist.
Right.
And so it is a deal breaker. It has to be a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. How can it not be a deal breaker if you're Israel?
Mm-hmm. In terms of domestic politics, does Obama's insisting, perhaps insisting is too strong a word, does his indication that the peace process should go back to the 67 borders as a starting point, will that hurt him significantly with Jewish campaign donors and Jewish voters in the U.S.?
Well, not necessarily. I think the people who are upset with what Obama said about the 1967 borders are people who would not have voted for him anyway and probably would not have been donating to his campaign in the first place. The issue is that the idea of the 1967 borders as a starting point is not Obama's idea. That's not new. And that since Clinton, that's kind of been the implicit policy of the U.S. Not that Israel should go back to those borders, but that should be a starting point for negotiations that would allow Israel to annex some of the settlements in the West Bank in exchange for land mm-hmm. that they give to the Palestinians. The problem with what Obama said is that it was far more explicit, and that some of the stuff he said that isn't getting as much attention is that Palestine should be contiguous, mm-hmm. which essentially means Israel can't be contiguous. It would cut Israel in half.
Yeah.
And that Palestine should have borders with all the surrounding states, but Israel's borders, he mentioned only Palestine, but Israel shares borders with Egypt, with Lebanon, with Syria. So, you know, to mention Israel as having only borders with Palestine in the Mediterranean and Palestine being contiguous means chopping Israel into very small, indefensible pieces. That's a problem from the perspective of Israel. That's a legitimate problem, and it's a non-starter as well. But the idea, the whole 1967 borders, Obama threw Israel under a bus, stuff that came out immediately, you know, presupposes that this was Obama's idea, and this is not Obama's idea. Clinton, this has been, since the Oslo Accords, this has been the implicit position of the United States, that that's a starting point for negotiations, but by no means will those final borders look like the pre-1967 map.
There were even discussions during the 2008 campaign or whisperings that Obama and the Jewish lobby, if you will, were not going to be terribly cozy, that he would throw people with an interest in the preservation of Israel under the bus. So this has been sort of a whisper campaign for quite some time. Is it justified or not?
I think it depends on who you ask. I mean, military support for Israel is not going away. Obama did come out and say, you can't have negotiations with Hamas. They fail to recognize Israel. You can't have negotiations when you have terrorism occurring. And Israel's security is important to Israel. It's important to the U.S. I mean, he said a lot of things for Israel to like. The importance of the border issues can't really be understated. I think that, you know, talking about Israel and pre-1967 borders as if though that were somehow going to solve this problem, you know, that will create a wedge between Obama and what little Jewish support that he had. Again, throwing them under the bus is too strong. This is not something that Obama came up with on his own. This is not something he created. And we haven't abandoned Israel. And you can't in this electorate abandon Israel. You shouldn't abandon Israel. They are an ally in a region where we have very few friends.
Mm-hmm. Netanyahu also, I believe, said that accepting Palestinian refugees back in
not going to happen
was not going
it's
to happen.
It's a non-starter, and I mean, they're not that you had just as many Jewish refugees from Arab countries as you had Palestinian refugees from Israel, and there's not going to be a population exchange. It would not allow Israel to exist as a democratic Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
It would not happen. You know, there are already a million Arabs living in Israel, and they none of them have any interest in leaving Israel for any of the other surrounding Arab countries because they enjoy more liberty in Israel than any of their brethren outside of Israel enjoy. And, you know, to talk about right of return is to kill the peace process. It's a non-starter. If there's anything that's a non-starter, that's it. It's not, and he said that. Netanyahu's not, I mean, he's very clear about that.
Right. So we're back to this conundrum of trying to find that shop-worn phrase, a two-state solution.
Right.
Are you tired of hearing
I think everyone's,
people say two-state solution?
Everyone's tired of hearing about the two-state solution, and, you know, the issues that have to be overcome in order to get to a two-state solution are pretty difficult issues, and pushing that ahead too fast, and I realize that that this is a long, drawn-out process. And in American terms, you know, we are microwave foreign policy people. We want answers, and we want them now, and we want implementation, and we want results.
We want instant gratification. That's
right.
Our society.
And that doesn't work here. And so while many people are impatient with this process, the idea of establishing two states too quickly, I think, leads us down a more dangerous road. Because if you have conflict between a sovereign state of Israel and a sovereign state of Palestine, you have set the stage to line up allies on both sides against one another in an interstate conflict. Right now, we have a pretty low-intensity conflict. I realize it gets a lot of attention, but in the big scheme of things, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not that deadly. It's, you know, it is a low-intensity conflict. Two states in a border conflict is not going to be a low-intensity conflict.
It sounds like in this section of the world, if you draw the borders in a brainless frenzy, you could be setting the stage potentially for something with nuclear complications.
You could, and we drew the borders with brainless frenzy when we decolonized the global south. I mean, that's why we have many of the problems that we have today. And so doing, you know, changing those borders is not something to undertake lightly, and setting borders is, I mean, border disputes are the most dangerous disputes in the world. They escalate at a much higher rate than disputes over any other issue. So while this is a slow process, and this is something that we are very impatient and we feel like needs to be resolved before the 2012 elections, that's unrealistic and dangerous.
Well, Iraq was drawn up by the British in a brainless frenzy. At least that has been the argument in the aftermath, and something that we came to learn after Operation Desert Shield and then Desert Storm. Let's talk about the Arab Spring for a second. One editorialist I read online said they thought that it was too optimistic a misnomer to call it the Arab Spring. It makes it sound as though there's going to be a kumbaya revolution all across the Arab states because these conflagrations are taking place seemingly in a domino effect kind of way, to Tunisia, to Egypt, to Libya, to Yemen, Syria, this and that. But that doesn't necessarily mean or spell the onset of region-wide cataclysmic change, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't even spell the onset of a decent amount of political change in any one country, much less across an entire region. Just because they are changing regimes doesn't mean they're going to change to some type of regime that is better for the people in those countries, although in some cases it would be hard to get much worse. It doesn't mean that they're going to develop, you know, political and civil liberties that we would equate with democracy. And in Egypt, I mean, again, Egypt probably had the best chance of doing this. Why? They had a relatively autonomous judicial system in terms of the rule of law. They, you know, a functioning state for the most part. If anyone's going to be successful, it would be Egypt.
And official relations with Israel since Camp David.
Yeah,
right?
Good relations with Israel for the most part, and good relations with the United States. And in that case, I mean, even in that best case scenario, I'm not optimistic that you're going to see something that would please Western audiences, I suppose.
And if it harkens to mind the 1968 Prague Spring, bear in mind that that Prague Spring was quashed by the communists rolling into Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, and you can see around the region that the response of the current autocratic regimes is a brutal response, and it's not an unexpected response if you know anything about politics. And we can't, and we shouldn't, be trying to militarily impose democracy in these places, even if we feel like we are doing so on behalf of people who want democracy, even if we feel like we are preserving human dignity or human rights in some way. Military operations, you know, in Libya, for example, are a terrible mistake.
Then how do you feel about the G8 nations trying to throw financial aid behind these uprisings?
I think it's interesting. I was reading, I think it was yesterday or today, that there's in the case of Egypt, there's this push by the developed nations. There's a debt forgiveness, $1 billion, I think I read, of debt forgiveness for Egypt, and a guarantee of a new set of loans. And the rationale for debt forgiveness is this was an autocratic regime that took on the debt, and so we don't want to saddle a democratic regime with that debt. And I think that, you know, that's reasonable. But then to open it up and say, now we're going to open up another line of credit for you, so you can put your country back in debt again to the Western powers in order to develop economically, is maybe a little bit short-sighted and historically, these debt-ridden countries do not do well in transitions to democracy are difficult under the best circumstances, and this is not the best circumstance.
It sounds like a power play on the part of the West that could backfire in that you don't really know what kind of a regime you're going to be getting or aligning yourself with. Things are still a bit turbulent for you to bank on getting the kind of leadership, puppet leadership, or autonomous leadership that will be aligned with your own interests.
Yeah, it certainly it's a gamble. Partly, I suppose, it's, well, you know, if we step in and do this, China's not stepping in and doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allows us to continue to have some deal of influence in that region. And that makes sense from a foreign policy standpoint. And if you look purely at naked self-interest, which foreign policy practically should be about, then I suppose re-indebting Egypt to the West makes sense, I guess.
What degree of hope should people living in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, the places where these uprisings have taken place, Yemen, where that autocratic leader is still hanging on, what hope should they realistically have for some kind of regime change that would improve the quality of their lives?
As much as I hate to say this, not much. It's unlikely that you will have this Arab Spring, this regional domino revolution that everyone's speaking of. It's highly unlikely. Now, having said that, if I were living in Syria or Yemen, I would push that as well. I mean, as a citizen, you really can't expect them to do anything else. But
you kind of cling to anything that you think might work.
Right, because they're living in repressive states that have been awful and repressive for a long time. I mean, that's why you see so much, if nothing else, moral support around the world. I mean, even Israel is cheering for these Arab states because people instinctively can relate to that democratic impulse, or that impulse for freedom and liberty, and I'm no different in that regard, but I don't have a lot of optimism in this case, and I think it's just from studying democratic transitions historically. Even the ones that get off the ground most of the time do not become consolidated.
It strikes me, though, that the Western media, well, I can't say the Western media, because the only non-American media I've sampled on this issue is the BBC, so I shouldn't generalize. But it seems to me that American commercial news media have covered the Arab Spring as though it is the feel-good story of the year,
or
the feel-good international story, or the feel-good political story of the year. They're covering it as if to say, thank God, there's finally something for us to feel good about. The economy stinks, and we have political discord, and this and that, and they are building this up to be a gift from God, practically.
Yeah, we're a very shallow and superficial consumerist culture when it comes to media, and people like that. And when it all goes wrong, the depth of coverage will be even more shallow, and because the U.S. electorate, and perhaps this is rational, I don't know, is not all that concerned about what's happening outside of the United States. And so if something good, quote unquote, mm-hmm. for the United States happens, like a democratic revolution in the Middle East, if in fact that's good for the United States, they'll cover that. But when this all goes to hell and these regimes are still there and these crackdowns continue, our attention span is not that long.
Why is the situation so intractable in these particular Arab states? Yemen has been no man's land for a long time. It all started in Tunisia, where one poor soul got attention with self-immolation. I mean, that's how this whole thing started.
Mm-hmm.
One guy set himself on fire and killed himself that way. Why are these situations so intractable in these respective nations?
Autocrats don't leave power willingly. I mean, they're not going to give up power willingly, because you can't play the game anymore. In a democracy, if you lose an election, you're not out of the game. You can do something else. An autocrat who loses power has no political future. And certainly, some of these people have been in power so long that they've become corrupted by that. But that, I don't think that's not unique to Arab countries.
Mm.
This is the way autocracy works.
Do people who are in touch with history also look at the example of examples of Anwar Sadat and in Israel Yitzhak Rabin and say, well, you try to make a progress change for the better, and you're going to end up with a bullet in your head?
Sometimes. I mean, yeah, sometimes, certainly. And if you look at the people in these countries, the ordinary citizens who are out trying to improve their lives, and they're not necessarily doing this because they have some kind of deep democratic impulse. I mean, the man who set himself on fire had his lunch cart, his food cart confiscated by the police and couldn't get anyone to listen to him.
This gets down to very basic stuff that basic gets
needs.
People where they live.
Yeah. I mean, you can... People will live in an autocratic regime, and they'll live rather quietly in an autocratic regime if they have economic opportunity, if their basic needs can be met, if they can go out and they can make a living. But when they can't do that, that's when this becomes, this impulse to change government becomes so prevalent. And so what you have here is you have this revolution, but it's really an economic revolution, which means any regime that can come in and provide some kind of economic stability and some kind of economic benefit will be fine. It doesn't have to be a democratic regime.
They'll take whatever improves your life at a very gut level. He may be a despot, but he's our despot.
Right, and life is okay here. Life, you know, it was like after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, very shortly after in Russia, when democracy wasn't going so well for most of the people in Russia, they wanted communism back. Latin Americans in 2004, more than half of them said they would trade their democracy for an autocratic regime if there were some economic benefits attached to it. People want to be able to work. They want to be able to provide for their families, send their kids to school. They want it to be a fairly decent playing field for them, and that's it. This isn't a liberal impulse as much as it is an economic impulse.
If nation building is still a crapshoot and perceived as Western meddling, does the U.S. have a role to play in all this or not?
You know, that's difficult to sort out because the United States has been waving this flag of democratization and liberalization. Really, I mean, we did this before the end of the Cold War, but during the Cold War, it was clearly an ideological battle. After the Cold War, we were left without a real clear foreign policy goal, without a real clear foreign policy agenda. So we grasped the first thing that we got a hold of, which was democracy and economic development. And so, you know, we've been talking this game for so long that our reputation is tied to it. And globally, our reputation is tied to it. And the difficulty is there's not much as an outside power that we can do or that we should really do to affect change in these countries. These things have to be organic. They cannot be imposed, and they can't be militarily imposed unless we're willing to pay the cost. I mean, we democratized Germany and Japan. That was pretty expensive. And we're democratizing Iraq, theoretically, and that's going to be very expensive, and we shouldn't do those things. It's not the job of the U.S. government to do those things.
As a foreign policy practice, should we continue our long-standing tradition of playing both ends against the middle? God knows we've done it before with mixed results at best.
I mean, in my opinion, the foreign policy objective of any state, the United States being no exception, is to protect and promote the national interests of that state. We live in what we call an anarchic international system. There's no world government, and so every state needs to protect its own national interest. And if that means sometimes playing both ends against the middle, that's what the United States will do and does, and that's what all other states do as well. This is not a uniquely American enterprise. Foreign policy is not supposed to be guided by morality. In fact, when we do guide foreign policy by morality, we end up in a dangerous morass, and we don't really, that's not the objective of the state.
I think Jimmy Carter found that out after the end of his four-year term, did he not?
I don't know that he's learned that lesson. He seems not to have actually learned that lesson.
I see. What effect will the so-called Arab Spring have, if any, on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? Is there any connection there? Is there any impact to be had?
I think that depends on what happens in these states. I mean, Egypt and Jordan have been stabilizing forces in that region. They've had good relationship with Israel. Jordan seems to be fairly stable, but with Egypt, who knows? If Egypt becomes part of the anti-Israel Arab camp, that would not be good for the peace process, nor would it be good for relations with the United States, nor would it be good for the Israelis, obviously, and probably not for the Palestinians either. I mean, the Arab countries have not been friendly to the Palestinians. They've used this group of people to further their own domestic agendas, but none of these countries have made any effort to actually improve the lives of Palestinians. None of them have done anything to bring Palestinian refugees into their borders. And these are the same countries that expelled Jewish people when the State of Israel was created. You know, they use this as a rhetorical tool without without really any regard for that population. In fact, some of my students who've traveled and spent significant time in these Arab countries, the Palestinians are looked down on as second-class citizens, the ones that are there as refugees, and they're not treated well.
So from Arafat to the present, there's just been a lot of manipulation going on.
And that's going to continue. And if Egypt, becomes anti-Western, then that is likely just to be escalated and will make that region less stable. I mean, the stabilizing effect of Jordan and Egypt and their relationship with Israel has been very helpful in keeping the violence level manageable, if you will.
Perhaps the fact that King Abdullah is King Hussein's son and Queen Rania is of Palestinian origin plays a role in that, and Queen Noor is an American woman. Perhaps that all helps to stabilize our relationship and keep that friendship with Jordan going.
Yeah, and Jordan seems to be one of the few states in the region that is managing this relatively well, this Arab Spring, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are out of time, but it's been interesting. Thank you, Dr. Karen Peterson, Associate Professor of Political Science at MTSU.
Thank you for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.